Hello and welcome to this extra episode of Empire's Podcast Ottomans. I am Frank, your host. For those of you familiar with this show, you'll be aware that there's a whole lot of content that ends up on the cutting room floor. From really interesting historical persons, places, or events, I have an entire spreadsheet of cool stuff I'd love to fit into the regular show. But if I were to do that, then these episodes would end up being well over an hour long, and I'd risk boring everyone to absolute death. So, now that I've encountered John Hunyadi repeatedly in my research, I've since come to the realization that I can't do the man any justice until he gets his very own extra episode. If at the end you decide this extra was something you enjoyed, please take a moment and leave me a review on Apple Podcast or drop me a follow on Spotify as well as a rating. It really, really helps. In this extra episode special, I'd like to talk about one of the most fascinating characters of opponents of the Ottomans, the Hungarian Baron John Hunyadi. Way back when I was in high school in 1998, I was reading a book entitled The History of the Ottoman Empire by author Jason Goodwin. This was the book that ended up getting me completely hooked on the Ottomans, and one of the characters I immediately took a shine to was this John Hunyadi guy. Goodwin described in detail the political and social context of the Ottoman world at this time, and truth be told, a lot of this was over my teenager hormone-addled brain at the time. But one thing I intuitively understood was attacking a much larger opponent at night and under the cover of darkness. Stealth, surprise, economy of force, unified command, excellent and independent-minded subordinates, turning the tide of a battle against overwhelming odds. Yeah. This guy, John Hunyadi, this was a dude I could get behind. In Hungary today, he is held up as a kind of mythic King Arthur-level savior, whereas Vlad Dracula in Romania is held as a hero for stopping Murad II and stemming Mehmed's invasions. Vlad's overt acts of cruelty makes for a somewhat tarnished reputation, as you can imagine. John Hunyadi, though, seems to be loved by everyone. Germans, Poles, Hungarians, Moldovans, Serbians, and respected by Turks of today. If you've listened to any of the previous episodes, 16 through 19, you may have seen his name cropping up from time to time. And in this extra episode, we're going to touch on the early highlights of Hunyadi's exploits. No other person managed to upset the Ottoman strategic apple cart quite like Hunyadi. We will start with his birth, attempt to pin down dates as best we can, important life events, the early battles that gained him fame, and finally, we're going to skip over to his death. Now, for the Balkan history buffs out there listening to my podcast, I hope I'm not disappointing you by skipping over the Crusade of Varna. But I'll be covering that in depth in the main show, and I want to avoid repeating myself. I'm also going to be jumping over the political and military events in Europe that John Hunyadi participated in. Truth be told, guys, I could do an entire episode, more than that, multiple podcast series on just the man, his travels, his battles, his triumphs, his failures, and his political machinations in Italy, the Holy Roman Empire, Hungary, Poland, and virtually everywhere in Western Europe. But all of that is way beyond the scope of a podcast dedicated to the Ottomans. So we're going to step into our time machine and jump to his birth, his upbringing, the making of the boy into a soldier, his early victories against the Ottomans. We're going to mention his son becoming the future king of Hungary, the birth of his legend in Western Europe. Then we shall stop at Varna and skip over to his death in 1456. So, thank you for coming along for this ride, and now let's jump in. We think that John Hunyadi was born sometime in August of 1406. And we say think because the origins of the man are shrouded in both myth and controversy. If you spoke with a contemporary Wallachian, they might tell you Hunyadi was the illegitimate son of Sigismund, king of Hungary, or that a runaway and disgraced priest had taken liberties with his mother, that is, if you talked to the Ottomans. If you happened up to Bohemia, they would attempt to sell you on the idea that Hunyadi's mom was actually a well-respected tavern lady. So, on the subject of his mother, let's just say that the record is so full of holes, contradictions, and downright lies, we have no idea who the heck the lady was. When John Hunyadi does appear in the historical record, it was on October the 18th, 1409. King Sigismund of Hungary, and yes, that same king who was present at the Crusade of Nicopolis, well, he granted lands, titles, and a castle to Hunyadi's father. Located deep in the woods of Transylvania, in the northern part of the country, the winters were harsh, and the family were forced to hunt for most of their food. It's not that they couldn't afford food, it's just that the remote location, the scarcity of trade in that region, well, it made things difficult. It is said that John's early upbringing was filled with hardship, exposure to the elements during log hunts, and sleeping outside. This whole living like a wild man thing may also have been part of his persona built up by allies during his lifetime, but most of them were written long after he died. Either way, even his contemporaries describe a man at peace in nature, not frightened to forge a path through the woods, so eerie that they would serve as the setting for Bram Stoker's horror novel, named after yet another legendary associate of Hunyadi, Vlad Dracula. Hunyadi developed a penchant for night attacks and moving about in winter when most armies were camped, so who knows, maybe the tales of the wild man aren't so far off the mark. When Hunyadi turned 16 or 17, his father sent him to live with, study under, and generally serve with the Italian soldier, Filippo Scorsoli, an incredible personality, born in the hectic periods of the warring Italian states. He was a brave soldier, shrewd tactician, and if the accounts are to be believed, popular with the noble women of his day. More importantly, good old Filippo was a close ally of King Sigismund. Sigismund had inducted Filippo into the military order of chivalrous knighthood, known as the Order of the Dragon, a group dedicated to never signing peace treaties with the Ottomans, and always, always willing to take up arms and fight the Turks wherever they showed up. Membership in this order was no small feat. The ceremony was public, the oaths permanent and solemn, and in the Catholic world, breaking a solemn oath or vow was a mortal sin, bound to send one straight to hell. Along with the membership would come prestige, money, and obligations. Among its alumni were luminaries such as Filippo, the king, and the later Draculas of Wallachia. In fact, the Dracul clan membership in the order would become a bone of contention with the sultans, something we will cover later. In examining legends, the creation of myths, I think that every national hero, well, they have something of a forerunner, someone who blazed a trail before them. Before Hunyadi became a legend, I think, and this is just my opinion, that the forerunner of Hunyadi was this guy, Filippo. He was proud, an intractable enemy of the Ottomans, and deeply religious, despite his gallivanting. He was loyal and assuredly brave. His mastery of small squad tactics would enable him to take on much larger opponents and become a power broker, not just in the Balkans against the Ottomans, but in the larger politics of the Holy Roman Empire, the Italian states, and so on and so forth. Where our friend Hunyadi is concerned, our young man was treated to a front row seat on all things military, from one of Western Europe's finest minds, logistics, the all-important art of making sure your soldiers have food, clothing, medical care, and equipment. Tactics, the artful employment of professionally trained mercenaries balanced out with conscripted peasants. Leadership, identifying men of ambition, bravery, and initiative within your ranks and promoting them based upon their merit. Not only would Hunyadi drink from the fountain of the military arts from Filippo, but the Italian would instruct Hunyadi in an even more important arena, that of politics. The world of 15th century Europe was a tired, confusing, and dangerous place. One of the recurring problems Western Europe faced was its lack of stability. When we talk about Hungary or Serbia or Wallachia, or even that of France or England, we tend to think of them as modern nation-states that we grew up in or we are familiar with. But back in those days, in the 15th century, these areas barely even qualified as countries. The boundaries were murky and in a constant state of flux. When we say king, what we should really be thinking about is something more akin to the mafia dons in the 20th century United States. Personal bonds, family ties, petty jealousies, all these trumped alliances and treaties. Who your cousin was married to mattered more than if your king was in an alliance with so-and-so and so-and-so. When we pull up a map of the Balkans thereby in the 15th century, and we look at these entities like Serbia and so forth, always keep in mind that the reality on the ground was much less certain. This is important to grasp because if we are to understand the life and times of Hunyadi, after all, how can we explain his capture by fellow Catholic Christian, Durar the despot of Serbia, after Hunyadi suffered a battlefield defeat? And in this event, Durar almost handed him over to the Ottomans. Or how can we explain, after Hunyadi defeated a large Ottoman force just south of Transylvania, his forces were also attacked in their rear by fellow Order of the Dragon member and also enemy of the Turks, Vlad Dracula? At this point in time, every single European should have seen the Ottoman Turks for what they were, a world-altering force set loose that could conquer them all if they didn't unite and do that fast. However, the reality of the situation was so much more complex. The nation-states of Europe wouldn't really start to come into their own until midway through the 17th century and beyond. Until then, the Ottomans would be facing a still formidable foe, capable of uniting into an unstoppable military force in the form of a dedicated crusade, yet a force that was constantly ruptured and fractured at its very core. Into this dangerous world, Hunyadi learned what to do if your rich older cousin announced that he was king one day, or if your far-off relative requested you aid them because said cousin had unseated his throne. Filippo also taught Hunyadi the value of saving your money and then loaning it out with interest to the great scions of the day, kings, high-level knights, the dukes, the barons, as they fought for political control. We can boil down three essential lessons Hunyadi picked up from Filippo. First, military shrewdness and mastery of using his mercenaries. Second, the political ability to always come out one step ahead of power struggles, avoiding assassinations, and placing men loyal to yourself into positions of power, and placing them in the courts of kings and dukes, who owed their positions to Hunyadi personally. Eventually, Hunyadi's system of personal patronage would extend to kings themselves and see Hunyadi elevated to the baronhood in Hungary. Third, Hunyadi learned to be frugal with his money, not spending it on flashy cars or private jets, and not giving a damn what color his Bugatti was, nor trying to sell you shady little internet self-help videos. He would save then loan his money to kings and dukes who needed to raise armies. And when the campaign was over, he was cashing in big time. if the said king or duke couldn't pay up, well, our friend Hun Yadi was always happy to take payment in the form of forts, towns, and lands. He often requested this territory and towns bordering the Ottoman Empire, of which the kings were all too happy to hand over, as they had trouble finding anybody that wanted to be that close to the Turks anyway. Hun Yadi would take these holdings and turn them into fortresses against not only the Ottomans, but his political opponents as well, leaving him a vastness he could retreat into, hoard his gold, collect more soldiers, and plot his next move. Now, let us circle back around to good old Filippo. In 1416, the King of Hungary invited the warrior to enter Hungary and Serbia to fight the Ottomans. As a reward, the king granted Filippo land, titles, and men. Tagging along with him was young Hun Yadi. From 1416 through 1419, Hun Yadi made himself the right-hand man of Filippo as they fought off incursions of Sultan Mehmed I. Fighting was brutal and intense, especially around Belgrade, the capital of Serbia. Belgrade will become a focal point, not only of this extra episode, but also of the main narrative. Sitting on the confluence of the Savu and Danube River, the city is the gateway leading into Hungary and up from there into wider Europe. A center of trade, the roads winding down from the Holy Roman Empire, Poland, Russia, Austria, and up from Italy, well, they all come together into the city of Belgrade before fanning out into the wider Balkans. A center of trade and a powerful economic engine for whomever controlled the city. The Ottomans have been trying to get it since the time of Murad I and the First Battle of Kosovo, of which I covered in Episode 7. And the city changed hands frequently between Hungary, Bulgaria, and Serbia. In 1426, this great Italian scion, Filippo, died. His military contingent, although disbanded, would later reassemble under Hun Yadi some years later. By 1427, Hun Yadi was up in the court of the Hungarian king, and he immediately set to work working behind the scenes, plying the knowledge taught him by his Filippo, and he set about gathering allies, building loyalties, and spreading the word that he was able, willing, and eager to be the king's man, the one to fight the Ottomans. In 1429, all this political maneuvering paid off. Hun Yadi's fortunes went to the moon. King Sigismund married his daughter Elizabeth to Hun Yadi that same year. The two would go on to have two sons, of whom would be royalty, one of which would eventually become King Matthias of Hungary. I'm not going to go into too much, but these are some extremely interesting personal stuff. But let's suffice it to say that his position at court, though never 100%, was greatly strengthened by this marriage and subsequent birth of royal princes. From 1430 through 1433, Hun Yadi was sent to Italy, along with a hardcore group of Filippo's top officers and men, to fight in some dumb Italian warring states conflict. I'm not going to dive too deep, but it was a sad diversion of resources, when really, guys, what the hell are we doing? Murad II is here, and his son is going to take Constantinople in 1453. What the hell is wrong with you? Hun Yadi returned from Italy in 1438, and it was good timing. The despot of Serbia, whom we met in episode 19 earlier this week, had realized that his daughter's marriage to Murad mattered for very little. And the Ottomans had besieged and taken the fortress of Smederevo. Next up on the menu for the Ottomans was the city of Belgrade itself, with all the importance I just mentioned. The despot of Serbia went to Hungary, screaming, begging for aid. The King of Hungary, King Albert, whom had just been elected Holy Roman Emperor, elevated Hun Yadi to a high-level baronship. The king also made Hun Yadi his top man in Transylvania, along with the southern borders of Hungary, all with an eye to bolstering defenses against the Ottomans. Now, we might think that unifying against the Ottomans would be a simple matter, but as I just illustrated, the haphazard nature of things caused some trouble for Hunyadi. For one thing, although Wallachia had been invaded and forced into vassalhood by the Ottomans, its population was majority Eastern Christian Orthodox and very, very hostile towards the Western Catholics. As a result, one ruler of Wallachia after another, called Vivodes, would be raised up and supported by either the Ottomans or Hungarians. The Ottomans typically supported Eastern Orthodox candidates to rule Wallachia, while the Western powers backed Catholic leaders. Trying to keep track of this or that noble family, cousins, uncles, and so forth, who would rise up and then fall and then rise up again and then fall again, is something I am actually considering covering in its very own extra episode on Wallachia, so stay tuned. When Hunyadi came to Transylvania, he used his connections in the royal court to grant lands and concessions to the local nobles, thereby securing their support. For the next year of 1438, Hunyadi took a grand tour of the lands in Transylvania, parts of Wallachia under Hungarian control, and slices of Serbia around the city of Belgrade still held by the West. What he saw, he didn't like. The local garrisons manning the forts, mountain passes, logistical hubs, river towns, and border forts were either irregular peasants or uncertain mercenaries. The peasants, as you can imagine, had been conscripted from their plows and stuffed into the unsanitary and hardship-rife forts, and desertions among their ranks common. The mercenaries, although professional, well, they weren't exactly paid on the regular. This meant they had a penchant of leaving their forts and looting the countryside, and generally terrorizing the local populations. Hunyadi spent the better part of 1439 and the first part of 1440 cleaning this mess up. He first made sure the worst of the mercenaries were punished, that the peasants were given at least limited amounts of training and rotated every 6 months, and the structural integrity of the fortifications themselves greatly improved. In the summer of 1441, with the forts very well garrisoned, Hunyadi took a small, hardcore contingent of his military, numbering some 1,400 men. These guys were mainly lancers, mercenaries, extremely well-disciplined, and professionals that were veterans of service in Italy and the Holy Roman Empire. Taking the long way through the mountains of Transylvania, Hunyadi's force surprised the Ottoman garrison and slaughtered them to a man. The Turkish commander attempted to retake the fortress, but he was killed. The Ottomans, deciding not to attempt a retake of the fort directly, sent a diversionary force numbering 17,000 men up through Wallachia, unopposed, I might add, by one of the Draculas. And yes, I'll do a special extra on Vlad in the future. The Ottoman force was composed of a few screening Akinci and irregular Rumelia Turks with little training. While marching into Transylvania, Hunyadi managed to isolate the Turkish vanguard and annihilate it. With their vanguard destroyed, the remaining 12,000 Turks decided it was best to head back into Wallachia and wait for reinforcements. However, Hunyadi marched for 3 days straight and then cut them off in the passes. Suddenly being attacked from both the rear and the front, the Ottoman force, already poorly trained and motivated, broke ranks and were cut down to a man by Hunyadi's troops. We are now getting to the part in Hunyadi's life where the man was about to give way to the legend. I'm going to cover two other very important engagements now, which Hunyadi would defeat much larger Ottoman forces and come out on top against all odds. But before we do that, let's do the whole Transformer song and switch to the Decepticons and pop our heads over into the tents of the Ottomans and see what the war is looking like from their perspective. First, the Ottomans faced two powerful enemies north of the Danube River. Their once puppet and world's favorite vampire, Vlad Dracula, was proving to be an unruly and rebellious vassal, which they needed to deal with, or their holdings in Bulgaria could be threatened. Second was this rather annoying Hunyadi. Not only were his, as yet small-scale victories, threatening to upset the strategic balance against the Ottomans, what Sultan Murad was worried about were more victories by this Christian champion. And who knows, what if he managed to defeat a larger Ottoman force? What would happen then? Would the Christians rally into another crusade? After the defeat of the force in Transylvania, Murad decided to tap into the great reserve of human potential available to him, the outstanding Sihab-ed-Din Pasha, governor of Rumelia and one of the Ottomans' best generals. Murad did his best to set his favorite general up with an army that would send fear into Christian Europe. 20,000 Akinchi, 3,000 Janissaries, and the rest composing irregulars from Anatolia. The total number of the army was some 70,000. Sihab-ed-Din jumped at the opportunity to lead this army. For years, the Ottomans had played cat and mouse with the Hungarians. This never sat well with the Pasha, whom was a long part of the war party surrounding the Sultan, constantly agitating for an aggressive expansionist policy. His objective was to pierce into Wallachia, depose the hated Vlad Dracula from power, then head north and kill Hunyadi. Hadim Sihab-ed-Din Pasha is an interesting character all his own. Born as a slave in Georgia, he started service in the Ottoman state as part of the Dev Shirmi, the boy tribute, and rose through the Ottoman schools for elite future administrators of the empire. He went to school in both Edirne and Bursa, serving in the court of Mehmed I, and now under his son, Sultan Murad II, Sihab-ed-Din was intelligent, a shrewd tactician, and very, very ambitious man. With this massive lead up to the battle I've just created for my listeners, I hate the fact that we are missing a ton of information on it, and I don't really have much to give you. I know that I've talked up this epic clash of titans, but the truth is, the materials out there say pretty much this, that the Pasha marched up like he was supposed to. While on the way up to find Vlad Dracula, Dracula's forces attacked him at night and cut most of his supply lines. Deciding to make his numbers more manageable, he formed them into smaller corps, three of which. The main corps under Sihab-ed-Din was caught between a river and thick woods by Hunyadi's forces, and at some point during the fight, the Pasha's army broke ranks and fled. Sihab-ed-Din escaped and attempted to make contact with his other two corps, but they had long since lost communication with one another. One was annihilated by the forces of Vlad Dracula, the other had retreated back into Ottoman territory. Sihab-ed-Din Pasha would go on to politically survive this disaster, though it would take his star until the reign of Mehmed II to rise again. In 1442, Sultan Murad II decided to send yet another army, this time composed of over 80,000 men. As far as the Ottomans were concerned, public enemy number one in Rumelia had gone from first the King of Hungary, then to their annoying vassal Vlad Dracula, but now shooting to the top space was John Hunyadi. This Ottoman army set off with the same list of objectives as the previous ill-fated attempt. Again, like the first battle, all we really know is that this Ottoman force set off from Bulgaria, linked up with a ton of Akinchi and Sapieha cavalry, who raided deep into Transylvania, though not as deep as they'd hoped, as a string of forts, courtesy of Hunyadi, was making raiding expensive and now difficult. Hunyadi met this army with a force of 15,000 men. This might not seem a lot by comparison, however, These 15,000 men, again, were all highly paid professional soldiers. A running multiple-day battle ensued, with Hunyadi fighting both the Ottomans and some forces loyal to Dracula, and I like to say that Dracula at this point seemed to be fighting everyone. Then Hunyadi decided to switch tactics. He opted for a surprise night attack that saw the vizier in command of the Ottoman army almost losing his life. However, the most important result is that the supporting cavalry was scattered. The next day, the Ottomans retreated, but this turned into a rout, and they ended up losing a ton of men. How much, we don't know. Christian sources claim the entire Ottoman force was lost, killed to a man by Hunyadi's own hands, no less. Whatever the case may be, the legend of John Hunyadi, already born, was now running on two legs with rockets underneath them. All over Europe, the exploits of this Hungarian warlord were read out loud in churches, and bells rang in his honor. Letters from the Pope and princes from all over Europe poured into Hunyadi's castle. Along with these letters came promises of material support in the form of money and men. Strategizing in his Transylvanian castle, John Hunyadi realized that the Ottomans were disorganized and demoralized after their defeats in 1441 and 1442. Hunyadi organized and raised mercenaries, thereby making good on the promises to him by the Pope, kings, and princes of Europe. The end result was a great army composed of some 35,000 men, under the nominal command of King Vladislav, which I should have mentioned that King Albert had gone to his eternal reward, and now we have King Vladislav of Hungary. But everyone knew who the real boss of the army was, Hunyadi. If you read military histories of the Balkans, then you'll know that this next phase from 1442-ish to 1444-ish is known as Hunyadi's Long Campaign in all caps. I'm not going to go into detail of this expedition, but I'm going to sum it up for us. From about 1442 to 1444, this 35,000-man army encountered hardship after hardship. First, supplies, promised by the Holy Roman Empire in Poland, simply never arrived. Then winter struck early, and the Ottoman resistance was tougher than previously assessed. Against all of this, the army headed to Belgrade in January of 1444 to camp for winter. Although this army hadn't won any major victories or reconquered land permanently from the Ottomans, it was absolutely stirring in Europe. Pope Eugenius and other powerful leaders began to agitate for a crusade and force the Ottomans out of the Balkans for good. Meanwhile, on the Turkish side, with Hunyadi's forces marching through Ottoman territory, Murad heard that in Europe, that talks of another crusade were going from what if to when. And the Ottomans were also finding out that their provinces in Rumelia were becoming a hard place to govern. Old landed nobles began to rise up, peasants were deserting their fields, the passes were shutting down, and criminal outlaw gangs seemed to be taking the place over. On top of all of this, these rebellions enabled Hunyadi's forces to enter deeper into Ottoman territory, especially into the newly conquered areas of Albania and Greece, and take over fortified town after fortified town. Now, to make matters more dire for the Ottomans, the Karmenids were raising a large army and threatening to march in from the east. We are getting to almost the end of this extra episode. I know I'm skipping over the Crusade of Varna, but trust me, it's better this way, and I promise to cover it in greater detail in the main episodes. This is also the point where I'll set the tale of John Hunyadi down for now. For you history buffs, I know this won't be satisfying at all, and I apologize in advance for this. But know that I'd love to cover the rest of John Hunyadi's military and political career from here until his death in 1456, but we simply can't do it. His life lived was full of conflict, political maneuvering, personal jealousies, and rivalries. From destroying a huge Ottoman naval flotilla that I wasn't even able to cover, to defeating the Ottomans at Belgrade, which we will cover in the main show, and many more battles, John Hunyadi truly lived the legend that was building up around himself after the long campaign. The Ottomans would have the names of John Hunyadi and Vlad Dracula etched into their cultural consciousness from here on out. From now on, when training new recruits, indoctrinating officers and men, the specter of Hunyadi was never far from the minds of the Ottomans. Much like Napoleon in the 19th century, the very presence of Hunyadi on the battlefield was enough to demoralize and disrupt Ottoman movements and plans. I'm going to end this by letting you know that on August the 11th, 1456, a plague broke out in the Crusaders' camp. This would be years after Varna, and Hunyadi died along with many of his men. His son would later go on, as I mentioned before, to become King of Hungary. We will have much more to say about the exploits of John Hunyadi in the future. In the meantime, I hope this primer, if you're new to the legend, was helpful. And I hope my sad attempt at painting a brief picture of the man did him some justice. One more note, if you've made it this far, I invite you to head on over to Apple and please, please leave me a review. Reviews are what really help Empires of History podcast The Ottomans grow. And while you're at it, please leave me a 5-star review on Spotify and a follow. Follower counts on Spotify. This helps me earn the podcaster's version of street cred around these parts. In the meantime, thanks for listening.